This is Unbroken, healing through storytelling. Just to let you know, we have a vodcast on YouTube where you can watch the edited highlights of the episode. And don't forget to subscribe. If you fancy the full audio version, simples, just keep listening. Oh, and if you've got a second, please give us 5 stars and a review. It really helps us stand out and get this important message to even more people that need to hear it the most. Meantime, enjoy today's episode.
Today, my guest is Mike Shinsky. Let me tell you a little bit about him before we speak to him. Mike says that his identity is not in his professional title, wealth, successes, failures, tragedies, relationships, but in Jesus Christ alone. He owes his life to him. He has an accomplished career with a few accolades. He's been an audiologist for 34 years and has seen well over 70,000 patients. He's worked in Navy and private hospitals to include NICUs, associate professor at IPFW University, private practice owner, and currently administers compensation and pension exams to veterans. He is married to a wonderful woman, Kate, and has 3 grown-up children. He feels that the tragedies in his life became the springboard to make a difference locally, nationally, and even internationally, and believes that regardless of differences as individuals, we all have a universal need to be loved, respected, and wanted. He chooses to make a concerted effort to make this world better, one person at a time, and found the best way was to get over himself and his struggles is to help others.
You talked about forgiveness. When this rape happened, when I went to the hospital, I made a decision for myself. I had to forgive who this guy was. But I've been blessed. The right people have come in my life at the right time,
yeah,
to see the right words, to give me the right encouragement. That has been a springboard again to allow me to move forward. Other people started coming into my life. There were a group of men that were in my life that said, hey, we're going to give you your space, but we're not allowing you to do anything destructive.
Welcome to the show, Mike. How are you doing?
Good. Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being with us. So the very first question that I ask all of my guests, because the show is called Unbroken, is what does that word unbroken mean to you?
Yeah, that's a powerful word, by the way, that you chose. And for me, I believe it's part of an oxymoron when I look at it from this perspective. The first is the tragedies that happened in my life with my wife, Shanna, is beyond a shadow of a doubt, it broke me. But however, I wasn't unbroken. And by that, I mean, I wasn't defeated. And the other part of this, to show you an example why it's an oxymoron for me, is as a believer, as a Christian, I acknowledge I'm a broken person and I'm in far need of greater than someone than me. And that's through Jesus Christ. And he has made me unbroken. So for me, that word is an oxymoron.
Yeah, that's that. You know, every week I get a different response from everybody, and it's been quite a few episodes so far, and I haven't heard anybody call it an oxymoron. But yeah, I understand that. So you were married to Shanna for how long?
For 6 years.
6 years.
In 2002, and then she died in 2008.
Yep, and you've told me that she was raped, wasn't she? She was held at gunpoint and raped. Was this during your marriage or before you met her?
No, it was during our marriage. So just the short of this, Madeline, is we happened to meet for lunch that day, and this was on December 10th, 2002. And I got her camera just a few days ago. And we lived on Hilton Head Island, which is a beautiful island. And she wanted to surprise me and go take pictures. So she went on the beach that we're married at. And it was overcast, the waves were very high and rolling, and so she started taking pictures, and she noticed a man walking in the distance, and something told her, like, this is out of place, I should leave, and she goes, no, you're overreacting. So she did it, and she started to leave. You have to go through the boardwalk, and it's covered with all kinds of foliage, so you're a susceptible area. 2 ladies passed her by, and she said, you know, I should have stopped them, but I didn't. And so as she gets closer to the restrooms, that's where he came from behind her, put a gun on her, and took her into the restroom. The first thing, we all, at least for me, I live with some level of guilt. It doesn't control me. It doesn't identify me. But to this day, it can be a trigger for me. So when I started my
practice, what is your guilt about?
So we, as you know, when you run a business or practice, finances are a key thing. And back in 2001, phones and the services weren't as cheap as they are now. So I was paying probably over $600 a month for two of us with phones for unlimited minutes, whatever. And so we made a decision to cancel the services just to get the practice up and running and try to cut costs if we cut costs. So that man left her in the restroom alone, and she reached for her purse and stuck the leaf of a cell phone. You know what? It wasn't there because I canceled it. So I live even to this day, and still choked up this day, that I took that escape away from her. And even though it was a decision as a couple, I still deal with that every single day, that I took that one out, that could change the course of what happened to her. And of course, he raped her. She begged for her life and said, you know, please don't kill me, that I have kids at home. And he let her live, took the memory card out. And then we started the journey of chaos for the next 6 years.
And she was able to tell you straight away what had happened to her?
Yeah, so my practice was located in the medical pavilion that was attached to the hospital. So I got a call from the ER, and they said, hey, your wife's in the ER, you need to come here. So I go there, and then just, you talk about out-of-body experiences. When things or crisis happens, it's surreal, the word. You're trying to process it, and you can't process it. So that's when I found out she shared she was raped. And, you know, the thing that stands out in the ER, this nurse told her that, hey, honey, don't worry about it. You'll get over it. And I'm just thinking, like, whoa. So they did the testing, whatever they had to do, sent her back home. And I believe the first few days she was constantly taking showers to wash the filth, the dirt away.
Yeah.
Come home, find her in the fetal position. It started this whole assault on her psyche and her well-being. And in this process, you know, while this is going on, there's still two kids in the household we have to raise.
And how old were your children at the time?
So Brooklyn was 4. And Logan would have been 9, I believe.
So just young, little young, who need their mummy.
And I didn't tell them either. Yeah. I just told them she was sick. And you'll see as this unfolds, is there are many suicide attempts with her. And that was the hardest struggle, is we started intervention with the counselors, with the psychiatrists. Of course, medication came into play, lots of medication. And I liken it to like she's the walking dead.
Mm-hmm.
She was physically there, but she was mentally checked out. And we would have moments to where we would have this joy and this happiness, but then just her will to live and being able to deal with the pain that she's dealt with or having to deal with was just too much. The process itself, Madeline, as you are aware of, is, you know, we had to go to the police, and ironically or interestingly, the victim advocate called me and said, hey, let me go with this instead of you, because you may be too emotionally charged, but I'm used to dealing with this. And I go, well, why would you go instead of me? Well, what usually what happens with rape victims is more of an interrogation versus an investigation. And sure as heck is that they pretty much attacked her.
Mm-hmm. It's shocking to hear that, isn't it? When you're most vulnerable, you really need support, and actually feels like you're interrogated.
Yes, absolutely. And she was crushed. And obviously, you know, how do I deal with this? So as a spouse, rage, anger, and, you know, a thing today that still bothers me is that happened on my watch. This is someone I was supposed to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened on my watch. And I failed in that regards. And I know it wasn't a failure, but just I hold it to this day that, you know, I was supposed to protect him. If I would have did some things different, this would have never happened. But obviously...
And the therapist in me wants to ask you, what could you have done differently to prevent this? How could it possibly have been your fault?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And it's just funny how you still carry, you know, stuff with you just because of the tragedy that's involved with this in our journey. I tried to, for the children at home, to make this as normal of a life as possible. So I didn't necessarily keep count, but I'm willing to bet that there were probably 14 suicide attempts. A couple of them were really close, and there's obviously one that was successful. And then ER visits, a quick look through a McDonald's drive-thru, we lived out of ERs. And we had to do the juggle act. She's in the ER. I have to run my practice. I have to take care of the kids. Like, I was used to running 100 miles an hour. Yeah. And my persona changed too. Like, I had no time for nonsense, no time for people who weren't genuine. I was just a very methodical matter of fact, because that's what I had to do to the family.
And did your family or friends know about what had happened to Shanna?
Yes. Yeah, so the family knew in the friends, but this was the lonely journey. On my end, it was lonely. And then for her too. And this is why. There's this thing called the tongue. And there's called gossip and ostracizing.
Yeah.
And then you add on it is I'm not a psychologist, but she developed all types of psychological issues. And, you know, there's the whispers, whether people in church or in the community would know she attempted suicide. And ironically, you know, I can have cancer and people are going to feel sorry for me. You know, I could get hit by a car, whatever. But to say that you have psychological issues, people don't want to be around that.
Yeah, there's still a stigma, really, isn't it? And actually, she was just responding from her trauma. She didn't have mental health. It was her trauma that was acting up. Absolutely. Which is a perfectly normal, natural response to a horrific event in her life.
It is. And you know, I don't have a reason why she couldn't quite turn the corner with this, but it was a battle. I believe sometimes the medication has a role to play, is you start adjusting medications, and that's how she tried her suicide attempts, a few times with the slitting her wrist or trying to stab herself with a knife, but 9 out of 10 times it was through medication. And so, you know, that was the tough thing. And again, to give you an idea, to keep normalcy for the kids, there's a time she attempted, I got her out of the hospital and we were planning to go on a trip. And I said, we're still going to go on this trip. We're not going to be defeated by this. And we're going to claim victory of this, and we're still going to go. So we took her just literally from the hospital. We went to SeaWorld so the kids could still live that normalcy. And remember, I never shared with them about these suicide attempts.
So that must be hard as well, knowing on one hand what had happened, but keeping up that pretense. It's like wearing a mask constantly, isn't it?
That's dead on, remember. At work, too, I could be seeing a patient, and my secretary says, you need to take this call. And she said, Mike, I can't deal with this anymore. I'm killing myself. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I dealt with this a lot. And just, you have to put on this persona that I'm this strong guy. And boy, I'll tell you what, it was just inside, though. It was just turmoil. But I had to do what I had to do. And that's how we were raised. You just pull up the bootstrap. My parents are old school. And you just trudge along. And that's exactly what I did.
And did you ever get support for yourself, therapy or counseling?
No. And this is why. Is in the end, it worked out. But the experience I had with Shanna was horrendous. With the counselors, with the psychiatrist. One psychiatrist even doubted this happened. I mean, it was bizarre. You know, I was in the ER.
They doubted that she had been raped? What, they thought she was making it up? Or
it was crazy. Like, I was in the ER and seeing the semen, and I can tell you, it wasn't me. Just the whole craziness of this. So I've lost trust in that system.
Okay.
And sometimes it got to the point where I couldn't go with her because, like, let's say the psychiatrist, with how they played with the medicine, said, you don't understand what this is doing. She had grand mal seizures. So the medication used for treating depression, anxiety, is sometimes the same as used for grand mal seizures. And so next thing you know, you're taking 6-7 of these different medications. And that's why I like an excuse for walking dead.
But eventually, the final attempt at her life worked, didn't it? And she did complete suicide.
Yeah, so that was the tough thing, Madeline, is and there's some irony to this, too. So on December 6th, we just got done, and this was 2008, putting up the Christmas tree. I put it up. Brooklyn and her decorated it. And then, for whatever reason, it was just like out of the blue, she had a meltdown. And we'd get these pendulum swings, if you will, with her behavior. She could be ecstatically joy. I'll use the word bipolar. Yeah. But and then she could be, man, just extremes one end to the other. So she had a complete meltdown, and it was just ugly in the house towards all of us. So I told the kids, hey, let's just we're gonna step out, let mommy just relax, we'll lay down, and we'll come back, we'll go out to eat. So we went out to eat, and my son says, do you think we should go back right away? I said, no, just let mom come down, she's gonna be okay. And so we finished eating, we went back, and she was gone. And that's when she went to sleep. I know she ingested a whole bottle of Tylenol, I think it was like over 100 pills. And we found her 70 miles away in another hospital. And that journey itself, again, that was, you know, surreal, just in the hospital.
And it's very hard, isn't it, for you, for your children, anyone that's listening. But I guess ultimately she was then in control of her life. She made that decision for herself. So it's awful. But in some ways we have to respect her choice as well.
Yeah, just the pain, Madeline. The pain was unbearable.
Yeah.
It really was. And, you know, you talk about forgiveness. When this rape happened, when I went to the hospital, I made a decision for myself. I had to forgive who this guy was.
Yeah.
This day, I harbor no ill will towards them, but I had to for my psyche. Initially, it was just words, because I had to put it into action. But I knew right there and then if I didn't, because I've already seen what happens, what lack of forgiveness does in a person's life.
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing really to do for them. It's actually all to do for yourself.
Absolutely. 100%. I agree with that.
Yeah. And was he ever caught or brought to justice? They ever found him? No.
You know, and it's interesting, about a year ago, I thought about contacting them to see if they could run the DNA through, if they still had it. But I said, just, I'm going to leave well enough alone. It's time to move on. I don't need to dig all this stuff up.
Yeah. So how did you and your kids come to terms with her death? And did you tell your kids how she died?
Yeah, at that point, she did. So when she was in the hospital in a coma, she coded, and I remember I told the physician, I want you to bring her back. So I want to get the kids and the parents back from the hotel to say their goodbyes. And the first thing I had the kids do, because I know the last thing you know in the body is the brainstem, and that controls the whole thing, auditory system still working.
Yes.
So I say, hey, you may not understand this now, but I want you to tell your mother you forgive her.
Yeah.
And because I don't want you to carry this burden of just this hatred for what she's done. So I let the kids have the moment. They forgave her. You know, I did too. And I also asked her to forgive me because, and I know better, but there's still a thing that I failed her.
Yeah. Oh.
So we did the forgiveness thing.
It's hard, that, isn't it? Because no matter how many times somebody says to you, you know, the only person responsible was the man who chose to rape her, there's still a part of you that's going to hold on to, well, I should have done better, or I could have been there. But actually, that's your heart. That's your head speaking. When you listen to your heart, you know you couldn't have done anything.
No, I absolutely agree.
So it's that push and that pull that's really hard to find a place to settle with, isn't it?
It is. So yeah, the suicide now, that's part two. So I lost my wife, first of all, mentally, the first time around through the rape. And then the suicide took care of the physical aspect.
Yeah.
So there's a fallout from suicide. So one, you have to deal with the rape. Now I have to learn how to deal with the suicide. And the kids are two.
And your kids were little then, weren't they? How old would they have been when their mom died?
15 then, in Brooklyn, 10.
Okay.
And in Brooklyn, this image, you know, our brains, we can never, it's sort of like a VCR, can never get rid of that image of this recording, like the hospital bed. And I say this because, you know, people aren't aware of this, they haven't heard, but I had to watch every heartbeat until she passed away.
Yeah.
I'm there to let her go. But the image of my daughter bringing in the sign in that hospital, say, hey, get well, mommy, come home soon. To this day, that just destroys me.
Yeah.
Innocent girl, just all happy coming into the hospital.
But how hard must it be for them to comprehend? You know, mums don't die when you're just 10 and 15. It's really hard for their minds to compute that, really, isn't it?
You can't. I mean, yeah. I have problems computing it as an adult.
Yes.
Children. So we had counseling for them. And then also, what was interesting is there was a fallout from the suicide. And one was with my family. And I love my family to death. There's reconciliation now. But at that time, I didn't know how to deal with the suicide. My family didn't know how to deal with the suicide. And again, my family comes from an upbringing, you pull your bootstraps up and move on. You know, my mom, she's going to stop and she took it down, but she's like,
it's a bit tough, isn't it?
Well, it is,
man. Tough love.
Get back to work a week later, get rid of all her clothes. It's like, Mom, I can't do this. So there was a falling out. And it's not necessarily, I'm not blaming them. I'm not blaming me because there's two sides to the story. But the suicide wreaked havoc in my family for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I had her parents. And what was good about this is other people started coming into my life. Is there were a group of men that were in my life that said, hey, we're going to give you your space, but we're not allowing you to do anything destructive with you.
Yeah.
They were on me like constantly. And then in my kids, again, they were in counseling in school and then private counselors. And there was good that has come out of this.
Yeah, that's what you said to me before we've interviewed, that in all this darkness, so much goodness has come from it. And that's really what I think people need to hear, because people couldn't imagine that goodness could come from something so tragic.
You're right. And, you know, my use of the terminology is you could probably come to terms with something a little bit better than what I used of getting over myself. But it is I could go in the spiral of the self-pity. And my identity was, okay, my name is Mike Shinsky, and I was married to a wife who was raped. I was married to a wife who committed suicide. And I had to make a conscious effort to say, that is not going to be my identity.
Yeah.
I'm going to use this for good. So that's when I started the international trips to all over the world, Nigeria, Ghana, Guatemala, Ecuador, Poland, Myanmar, China. One of my favorite stories is sort of like, I was a little reluctant to do this with you, is I didn't know, like, you know, what difference can I make? I listened to some of your speakers and I said, I don't know if this is going to help anyone.
Absolutely will.
I was in Nigeria with a bunch of guys, and we were sleeping in this old church, and we're supposed to go to this clinic the next day. And I couldn't sleep the whole night, and it was crazy. I was awake, but I got this vision of what I'm going to see in this HIV clinic, the people and all the stuff. And I started crying. All these guys are sleeping. I'm crying in the middle of the night. And it's like, you have a story and you're going to share it with these people. And mind you, outside of you, Nigeria, when I was in Myanmar, those are only three people that heard some of these details. So when I got to the HIV clinic, the AIDS clinic, it's exactly how I saw it. And I told my buddy, you know, I'm losing my mind. I just think it's sleep deprivation, but you know, I'm supposed to say stuff, but I don't think I'm going to say anything. I'm going to wait to see if the guy asks. So the director shows us around, and then there's dead silence, goes, hey, does someone have anything here to share? So right out the gate, I'm bawling. But I stand up and I tell these people, is I know what it means to be ostracized, to be isolated because you have AIDS. Mm-hmm. Your family always turned their back on you. Your friends have turned their back on you. And I shared with my wife suicide and the stigma associated with that and the rape and stigma associated with that and how I was alone. Even though I'm surrounded by people, I'm still alone. And there's always this at a distance type of a love. And so I was able to share that with these people. And I told them, I don't know how many were in this room, 100, 60. But I told them, I want to hug every single one of you and know that you love. And I says, I don't care what happens at this day before, to know that, you know, your life matters. I can tell you it matters. I came all the way here from the States to tell you your life matters and that you're loved. And I really mean that. And I'm telling you, I've never had so much endearing and loving hugging from all these people. One of them broke my glasses. They were hugging me so hard. It just shows you I went on the other side of the world to share my story and make a difference in lives with broken people, if you will. And there's all kinds of, another quick little thing I did is I adopted 10 families in the three city area, and I made a commitment to deliver food to them for 1 year. They didn't know me. I didn't use my professional name or my last name, because then, you know, then you got to worry about people associating you with money and wanting things. So I did this for a full year. I bought a truck. I took them a month's worth of food to 12 different families. And I always grabbed another man to go with me because there's a lot of single women involved with this. But here's a neat little story. So there's this one lady. When I first took these groceries to her, I got her name from Department of Social Services. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? I says, I'm just called to do this, and I just want to help you out. There's no strings attached. And so she opened the door like this. Enough to get the groceries to me. So over the course of the year, you know, the door's wide open, come on in. And she shared with me her story. She overcame, you know, she was not sure what term to use to, you know, just self-mutilation.
A self-harmer, yeah.
She became a foster parent to three young boys. And just, I heard so many good stories. So that helped my healing.
But it's almost as if when you started to drop into your heart, then you allow other people to drop into their heart as well. It's like her door opening is like her heart opening more and more to you, isn't it?
Absolutely, Marilyn. I mean, you talk about my heart open, it burst wide open. Yeah. And from that, I've lived and tried to continue to live a very generous life. Is I believe to whom much is given, much is expected.
Yeah.
And so again, I used what happened to me as a platform to make a difference in the lives of people that come.
Yeah, it's almost like a living legacy of Shana, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is. You know, you talk about the legacy. I have another friend, his name's CJ, his daughter died of suicide. Mm-hmm. And what I started doing recently is honoring living people with in their name scholarships to a lower income high school. And so this year I did one for my wife and his daughter, Ashley. And it was so real that through a living person, this 18-year-old girl, we gave a scholarship, I think it was a total of $3,000-$4,000 to give to her to start her journey on her college education. And what I've done is, so this topic was on suicide. She had to talk about suicide. She had to do the research. And ironically, herself had an incident with that as far as an attempt. So again, I used to make differences now, not for when I come. Because what I learned, Madeline, is she died. All this material stuff, I learned it doesn't matter. The house.
Absolutely.
And she had this nice fancy diamond ring. It was all worthless. And I realized the worthlessness of stuff. I have stuff. But I can tell you in a heartbeat, I can give it away in the blink of an eye if there's a need. I do it. And I've done cars, and not for bragging purposes, but it's just I'm not attached to anything I have materially. And that has been a blessing. So I can live large, and I can live small, and it has no bearing on my happiness whatsoever. Mm-hmm.
And you have since just got married, only October time, I think, haven't you, to Kate?
Yes. So we dated for 7 years. And as you can imagine, some lady friends will say, like, oh, my gosh, are you serious? And again, one of the things I've developed with this, I'm a very methodical or this is the way it's going to be just because of what happened in order for me to survive. And so I said, OK, the longest we'll date is 7 years. And if I'm not married in 7 years, we're going to move on. It's not going to work.
So she passed the test, I take it.
Yeah. Well, it was just for me, not necessarily for her too, but for me, that I said, like, you know, who wants to be married 3 times? I certainly did. Like, this last one with Shana was supposed to be for life. So I just said at this stage of the game, it has to be right. And it has been a seamless transition, and it's been a blessing. I don't know if I mentioned to you, so when I sold my practice, I was going to retire, and I've been blessed beyond anything I'd ever be capable of making the amount of money I did, but I was going to retire, and the recruiter found me, and I started doing these compensation and pension exams, and so I built this townhome in another city, let my fiance stay there, and I moved 4 hours away, and then I got an apartment. This was my coming home moment to where now I'm not running 100 miles an hour. Not working 70-80 hours a week, their children, doing all this outreach, came to complete. So the left is that I got this apartment. I just got a twin bed in there, a folding chair, and that's if I lived for probably a year. My son would come and said, "No, when they break in here, they're going to feel sorry for you and go break someone else's apartment."
They're going to leave you something.
But it allowed me to do a retrospective. Again, I focused on my work. I worked and managed a crisis hotline every Thursday for a full year for 2 hours.
So it's really put you on a journey of just giving and generosity and being open heart. But I'm hoping you look after yourself in all of this as well.
Yes. I am in a fantastic, you know, place in life and beyond a shadow of a doubt. And And maybe my way wasn't the ideal way I went about it, but just how my life unfolded and whatever circumstances. But I've been blessed. The right people have come in my life at the right time,
yeah,
to see the right words, to give me the right encouragement. That has been a springboard again to allow me to move forward with this.
Well, what I've learned through interviewing all these people, there is no right way. You know, we get through grief however we get through grief. And it often really helps with who we surround ourselves with and our mindset as well. And you clearly have good people in your team, and eventually you turned your mind around, and that's really what helped. So if anyone is listening right now, do you have any bits of advice that really helped you to really, I guess, accept the situation and overcome it?
There is. And these popped out in my mind right away. And again, first of all, I have to be, because this is who I am, but my faith. Yeah. I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, Madeline, that without Christ, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now. I've probably been on a destructive path. So man has failed me 100% of the time, but he is not. So that's my number one. The two is, do not isolate.
Yeah.
You know, Hemingway said, no man's an island unto himself. You have to stay connected with people. And importantly, you have to be connected with people who are going to encourage you, who are going to be positive.
Yes, the right people.
Yes, that's what this is for right here, Madeline. Cut the cord and drop the negative people. The third thing is forgiveness. And there is so much truth in this, and not just in this tragedy, but in a lot of things in my life, because with forgiveness comes peace. And if you don't, you put yourself in a self-imposed prison, and you'll never realize you're the one who has the key to walk out that door.
Absolutely.
So forgiveness is huge.
And we all have that key, don't we? I think,
oh, absolutely.
I think that is a perfect place to end our interview. So, Mike, I just want to thank you so much for showing us how you remained unbroken and for coming on the show. Thanks again.
Hey, God bless you. And I appreciate you, Madeline. And best of luck to you in your future endeavors.
Ah, you're welcome.
Unbroken. Healing through storytelling. If you haven't already, go on, download, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us get this important and life-changing message out to as many people as possible. There is already a selection of fantastic episodes to choose from, and a brand new one coming soon.
Unbroken, healing through storytelling. Playing now on all the main platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher for Android, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and here. Play Unbroken, the podcast, with Madeline Black.